Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Yeah, and this is episode number 170.
Yay!
And it's Halloween.
Yay! Happy Halloween!
Happy Halloween, everybody. So we're going to talk about Washington Irving's greatest hits, Rip Van Winkle and The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Sleepy Hollow has become a story that I've read probably 3 years in a row in October.
Oh, really?
There's just something about that. I just love it. Yeah.
Hmm.
I can't explain it, but I do love it, so.
Yeah, well, it is a great story. It's got, it kind of has everything. Well, both these stories do in a way. They take you to a far-off time. They take you to a bucolic American way of thinking time, you know, and when you're talking about in both these stories, when you're talking about Dutch settlers, I mean, that's past our national memory, really.
Mm. Yeah.
We don't think of that.
Especially in the West, right?
Yes.
So I looked at Washington Irving a little bit this time, or for the first time. I don't mean we've talked about it before, but I was surprised at one thing. Well, a couple things, I guess. Thing number one was that he was born right at the end of the Revolution. And I always thought in my head that he was like an adult during the Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the subject of these two stories, you know, what he says during them.
Right.
So that was a surprise to me. So he was born just the year that the ceasefire was called. So, living in the aftermath. I mean, he's growing up in the aftermath of the American Revolution.
Yeah, and in fact, I started listening to just the beginning one time of an old biography of him that was on LibriVox. And one of the interesting things at the very beginning was that they think maybe because his mother was friends with, or, you know, he had a well-off family, that George Washington actually might have held him when he was a baby. And then he grew up and did a 5-volume biography of George Washington.
Yeah, the Wikipedia entry says that he was named after George Washington.
Right.
So that's where he got his name, yeah.
Yeah, I always think of him as being a lot earlier because he's writing about those bucolic, far ago times. And I always thought, he was, you know, Henry Hudson, Washington Irving.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't contemporaneous. He was actually fabricating his own stories and setting them in that time period.
Yeah, right, right. And then the second thing you alluded to there is how well connected he was. I did not know that he was a diplomat. He spent a heck of a lot of time in Europe, working for the U.S. government at some points. And then there was a time where the family business failed, which I don't know how much he had to do with, but he had something to do with it.
He was supported by his brothers, who were very proud of his literary accomplishments, so they would support him if he needed it while he was getting going. Mm. But the War of 1812 was disastrous for a lot of American merchants. Mm-hmm. Because of, you know, English trade is cut off and supplies are cut off. And so he's left. I think he was in the war for a while. He was against it. And then when they attacked Washington, the British attacked Washington, he's like, well, that's it.
Yeah.
And he left and went back to try to help his family recoup their losses, but he couldn't.
Yeah, what a curious war that War of 1812 is. It's almost a forgotten thing. I say it's curious because they're fighting in 1812, and in 1819, 1820, Washington Irving is in England. You know, it's like it never happened, and they're doing their business there and everything. Rip Van Winkle and Sleepy Hollow while he was there, right?
While he's abroad.
Yeah.
Well, he was in England. And yeah, the War of 1812, that's one of those things where I've read enough about it because I'm a fan of Kenneth Roberts' historical fiction.
Mm.
Super accurate, but very entertaining to read. And he also was one of those first people who said, let me tell you about both sides.
Mm.
You know, Oliver Wiswell is set during the Revolutionary War. It's from the Tory point of view, pointing out that about half of Americans were not on the Revolutionary side. And so he wrote a fair number that were set during that real early period of history. And so I do know that the War of 1812, it was, you know, the British were kind of pushing back, going, maybe what can we get away with here?
Mm.
Maybe we'll just press all these. We're going to take all these ships and go, oh, you don't look like you're really American. We're taking all your sailors. So that's what was going on from the American point of view. There's probably other stuff. It's very simplistic. My point of view. And eventually the Americans were like, okay, that's it.
Mm.
We're not putting up with this anymore because the incursions got more and more egregious.
Yeah.
And that's when you had actual fighting and the British were landing again. And, you know, you have the famous right. Dolly Madison grabbing the picture of George Washington as the Capitol's burning and they're leaving.
Mm. Yeah. And then, everybody seems to have gotten over it very quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that a bad perception or?
No, I think they probably went back to business as usual, but you know how that is. Do mm-hmm. you really forget?
Yeah, yeah.
Washington Irving had so many friends or admirers because I was surprised to find he and James Fenimore Cooper were the two writers that everybody in Europe took notice of and made people say, oh, Americans can have a literary greatness.
Yeah, sort of the first two American writers that people considered great, I guess. Mm-hmm. The ones that Europe was reading.
Mm-hmm.
And then yeah. after them came people like Nathaniel Hawthorne yeah. and Melville and
Poe,
right. In fact, mm-hmm. The Wikipedia entry says something about a young Edgar Allan Poe seeking advice from Washington Irving on some stories. That would mm-hmm. have been a cool room to sit in. Another cool room to sit in is Charles Dickens. I guess visited him and, you know, he named his house Sunnyside. So I love that, you know, naming your house. I've got to name my house. I love
We've
that.
We've talked about that before. And actually, we came up with a name.
Hmm.
And we just never got the little sign made to do it with. It's Thalia, the Muse of Mirth.
How cool.
Yeah.
We should all name our houses.
I know. That's very British to do that. You know, yeah. The Larches. Mm-hmm. And so forth.
Yeah. So I guess late in Washington Irving's life, he was in correspondence with Charles Dickens. And then Charles Dickens had an American tour and stayed with Washington Irving at mm-hmm. some point during that. Which is nifty.
That would have been fun to be a fly on the wall for that.
Yeah. So, and he served with Martin Van Buren in England, in London. He worked for Martin Van Buren, and then Martin Van Buren was not renewed in that position, and then retaliated by becoming president.
Yeah, I'll show you.
Yeah.
Well, the thing cool. that interested me about Washington Irving is, you know, we know about Rip Van Winkle and the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and even The Devil and Tom Walker, which got rewritten into The Devil and Daniel Webster. I believe,
I didn't realize that.
Binet did. And, but the thing is, so I tend to think of him writing these very atmospheric ghost stories, or even in the collection that has these two stories in it, there are a lot of, you know, Christmas in England sketches, because the whole idea is that Geoffrey Crayon, it's the sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon, who wrote all these little things that would be in the paper or things like that. And it got collected into a book, I think, or maybe he wrote it as a book. However, the point is that I think of him writing that stuff, but he also was given full access to the Spanish papers for Christopher Columbus. And so he wrote a huge biography of him that was kind of like historical fiction. And they think that's maybe where the myth came from, that Columbus was proving that the world was round when everybody already knew it was round for centuries before. But that's how powerful his writing was. It took hold and never left. He, you know, as I said, he wrote that 5-volume biography of George Washington, and so he wrote in all kinds of genres too.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and he used pseudonyms quite a bit. Again, the Wikipedia entry talks about the word Knickerbocker. Mm-hmm. So Knickerbocker was, well, it was a pseudonym, but of a historian. He made up this name of a Dutch historian and even went so far as a kind of marketing ploy to post missing posters.
I know.
And say, this person is missing. We can't find him. And I guess it really captured the imagination of people because they really were looking for him. So
yeah, I loved that.
Yeah, and it became so popular that the word Knickerbocker became just a general term for New Yorker.
Yeah, the New York Knicks.
And there you go, New York Knicks, yeah.
Yeah, I really like that because they get down to, you know, the hotel's advertising. If he's not going to pick up his stuff and pay his bill, we are publishing this book that we found. And then everyone wanted to read the book.
That's right. That's like, right.
I wonder how the authorities felt who had been actually looking for the real Knickerbocker.
You know, that is so funny. That is such a today thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something you could do on Twitter or whatever.
But it's not new.
No, it's not. It's neat. It's, I love it.
People were probably doing it in Pompeii.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Probably so. That's funny. Oh, I love it. I love it. Well, let's talk about these stories. Let's start with Rip Van Winkle, if that's all right.
Yep.
Cool.
It's what I call the lesser of the two.
Do you? All right. That's, I like that's both, what I think. I like Sleepy Hollow best, but.
Yeah. Come on.
Come on. So Rip Van Winkle, so it was written 1819 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And again, he was in England, and he sent this over to that whole book, that crayon book. The Sketchbook of Geoffrey Crayon, Gentleman, is what this was contained in. And it's got a framing, some framing stuff in it, you know, talking about
his research.
Yeah, the research and stuff, right? So,
right.
Yeah. A posthumous writing of Diedrich Knickerbocker.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it just starts right off. You know, whoever has made a voyage up the Hudson must remember the Catskill Mountains. And the first thing that I have highlighted that I just loved is just a sentence or two later. It says, every change of season, every change of weather, indeed every hour of the day, produces some change in the magical hues and shapes of these mountains, and they are regarded by all the good wives, far and near, as perfect barometers. When the weather is fair and settled, they are clothed in blue and purple, and print their bold outlines on the clear evening sky, but sometimes when the rest of the landscape is cloudless, they will gather a hood of gray vapors about their summits, which in the last rays of the setting sun will glow and light up like a crown of glory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think he likes this place.
Well, and he's got such a beautifully descriptive way of writing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely does. Absolutely does.
I mean, he just takes you there because the next, I also had marked that. And then the next bit is, at the foot of these fairy mountains, the voyager may have descried the light smoke curling up from a village whose shingle roofs gleam among the trees just where the blue tints of the upland melt away into the fresh green of nearer landscape. It is a little village of great antiquity, having been founded by some of the Dutch colonists in the earliest times of the province. About the beginning of the government of the good Peter Stuyvesant, may he rest in peace. And there were some of the houses of the original settlers standing within a few years, built of small yellow bricks, brought from Holland, having latticed windows and gable fronts surmounted with weathercocks. And so he takes you from the mountains down, you see the forest and the village right there. You are in that place.
Yeah. As you were reading, it reminded me that you recorded this for Forgotten Classics.
Mm-hmm.
And I listened to it on...
Yeah,
I did. On Saturday.
Oh.
Yeah. Awesome.
Good.
Very, very, very good. But yeah, so you are the voice of Rip Van Winkle.
That's a very sad thing for me, but yeah. Okay, good.
Yes. Wow.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And Peter Stuyvesant, he's...
Stuyvesant,
right. He was an early governor of the New York area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They called it, what did they call it? New Amsterdam, I think.
Right, right.
Yeah. If you listen to the Bowery Boys, which is a podcast about New York City history, especially the early ones. Now, they're not, they don't go through in chronological order. They just pick things that they like and that you could go see, but they do a lot of the early history in the early parts of the podcast, of course. I mean, they're close to episode 300, I think, but they have an archive version of their podcast with the old stuff. And some of those stories are really great about those times.
Cool. Yeah. I'll check that out. Yeah. So in the next paragraph, we meet Rip Van Winkle and he's described as a simple, good-natured fellow of the name of Rip Van Winkle, a descendant of the Rip Van Winkles who figured so gallantly in the chivalrous days of Peter Stuyvesant, right? And accompanied him to the siege of Fort Christina. He inherited, however, but little of the martial. That comes up later. That comes up later. But little of the martial character of his ancestors. I have observed that he was a simple, good-natured man. He was, moreover, a kind neighbor and an obedient, henpecked husband.
Yeah, he's got a heck of a wife.
In your podcast, you talked about Fawlty Towers, which I absolutely love that show. And yes. So well written, so well written. But it's funny that you made a connection there.
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, is you are shown this really nice guy. He's a good neighbor. He's kind, all this stuff. But you kind of, as you go on, you find out he's not the salt of the earth like he could be. He's pretty lazy.
Mm-hmm.
He's always willing to catch a drink instead of mend the fence or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
So his wife might have some reason for being as awful as she is.
Yeah, go do something.
Mm-hmm. Help me out, buddy.
That's right, that's right. Yeah, let's see. This sentence is good. Certain it is that he was a great favorite among all the good wives of the village, who, as usual with the amiable sex, took his part in all family squabbles and never failed whenever they talked those matters over in their evening gossipings to lay all the blame on Dame Van Winkle.
Aww.
Yeah. So, yeah, so he's hanging out with all the other women.
And the kids. Right. He's playing with all the kids.
Yeah, and the children of the village, too, would shout with joy whenever he approached.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
Assisted the great error in Rip's composition was an insuperable aversion to all kinds of profitable labor. It could not be for want of assiduity or perseverance, for he would sit on a wet rock with a rod as long and heavy as a Tartar's lance, and fish all day without a murmur, even though he should not be encouraged by a single nibble. Hmm. Oh, that's tough. Tough duty.
Tough duty, right. Right. Yep.
And yeah, then, so essentially he'd help all his neighbors, but he would never do anything for his own family.
Right, right. And then the last sentence of the paragraph says, in a word, Rip was ready to attend to anybody's business but his own, which is what you just said, right? But as to doing family duty and keeping the farm in order, he found it impossible. Yep.
Yep.
Impossible.
It could be a little bit on his wife's side.
Absolutely.
And it shows the effect in not only the wife, but also in the family.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't have a father there as a presence. They also don't have a father taking care of anything. So their kids are all ragged. They're wild, you know.
Yeah.
His wife's doing everything on her own, and he's just like, he's off having fun and doing whatever he wants with everybody else.
Right, right. So. Yeah. And then, yeah, his son Rip promised to inherit his habits, you know, with the old clothes of his father. And then, you know, to belabor the point, he says this again. Rip Van Winkle, however, was one of those happy mortals of foolish, well-oiled dispositions who take the world easy, eat white bread or brown, whichever he can be got with least thought or trouble, and would rather starve on a penny than work for a pound.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's Rip Van Winkle. So he's out walking around the in the mountains.
And with his dog.
With his dog, yeah. And he lays down and goes to sleep. Are we jumping all the way to that already? There's not a lot to this story other than that, other than the descriptions of stuff.
Well, kind of the interesting thing, too, though, is in this one, he's showing you the life in the village a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
He takes you into the tavern some, and you meet a few of the people who are holding forth on, you know, their opinion of politics mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's not that he, later on, you go more into politics, but it kind of gives you the sense of the village, that he's part of this community. Not that, I mean, it just kind of really sets the tone. But the tavern is important later on.
Mm, yeah.
When he, at the end of the story, I think.
Right, right.
Just, you know, as a public place. But yeah, exactly. So then he's off hunting.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
and
it.
On a fine autumnal day, mm-hmm. right? Rip had unconsciously scrambled to one of the highest parts of the Catskill Mountains. He was after his favorite sport of squirrel shooting, and the still solitudes had echoed and re-echoed with the reports of his gun. Panting and fatigued, he threw himself late in the afternoon on a green knoll, covered with mountain herbage that crowned the brow of a precipice. From an opening between the trees, he could overlook all the lower country for many a mile of rich woodland. He saw at a distance the lordly Hudson, far, far below him, moving on its silent but majestic course with the reflection of a purple cloud or the sail of a lagging bark here and there, sleeping on its glassy bosom and at last losing itself in the blue highlands. Yeah, lots of description.
Yeah, because it says on the other side, he looked down into a deep mountain glen, wild, lonely, and shagged, the bottom filled with fragments from the impending cliffs and scarcely lighted by the reflected rays of the setting sun. And the thing that gets me is when you're reading this and thinking about it, and I'm thinking, our country is now so populated, it's hard to imagine what he was experiencing, because he would have been absolutely alone. Mm. There would have been no sound from people nearby, unless somebody else happened to be hunting. I mean, it was absolutely wild.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's emphasized then when he hears somebody calling his voice. He's like, what? No, that's not right.
Right, right. Yeah, so here's, see, as he was about to descend, you know, he heard a voice from distant hallooing. Rip Van Winkle, Rip Van Winkle. He looked around but could see nothing but a crow, winging its solitary flight across the mountain. He thought his fancy must have deceived him and turned again to descend when he heard the same cry. Rip Van Winkle, Rip Van Winkle. At the same time, Wolf, which is his dog, bristled up his back and giving a low growl, skulked to his master's side, looking fearfully down the glen. So, anyway, it's just really sets the scene beautifully. And then, you know, he hasn't fallen asleep yet.
No, that's later. But yeah, so then there's somebody there who's really odd looking, and his clothing is very old and antique. And he's got a keg that seemed full of liquor, made signs for Rip to help him carry it. He's like, figure. Well, all right. I don't know you, and this is super weird, but liquor? Okay. I'm in.
Yeah. We will carry that all the way up the mountain.
Yep.
Yep. Right. Distant thunder. Yep. We proceeded. Let's see.
We'd hear what he thought were distant rolls of thunder, and they come to the spot. And you're kind of, it says long rolling peals like distant thunder that seem to issue out of a deep ravine. So as they get closer, that gets louder. And so you're like, oh, what's going on in here? It's artfully written in that way. And so then there's a whole band of people.
Right. And he sees a whole bunch of bearded folks having a good time. They're like bowling, right? Playing ninepin.
And it says they remind him of figures in an old Flemish painting, which had been brought over from Holland at the time of the settlement. So that kind of tells you he's dealing with something very antique, even to him.
Yeah, yeah. They all had beards of various shapes and colors. There was one who seemed to be the commander. He was a stout old gentleman with a weather-beaten countenance. He wore a lace doublet, broad belt and hanger, high-crowned hat and feather, red stockings, and high-heeled shoes with roses in them. The whole group reminded Rip of the figure. There's that Flemish painting.
Yeah.
The village parson, in the parlor of the village parson, and which had been brought over from Holland, right? What seemed particularly odd to Rip was that though these folks were evidently amusing themselves, yet they maintained the gravest faces, the most mysterious silence, and were withal the most melancholy party of pleasure he had ever witnessed. That was interesting too. What do you think these things are?
You know, when I was young and I would read this, I thought they were like spirits.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now I think, in fact, isn't this posited at the end of the story that somebody says that they've heard that, was it Henry Hudson or somebody and his men got lost and their ghosts came back?
Mm-hmm.
I think, don't they say at the end of the story?
Yeah, I think that they do too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
What I like is they have him, they called him so he could carry the barrel. And then there's like, okay, can you be bartender, please?
Yeah. Right.
Just fill these cups up whenever we need it. And so, of course, he is like, no problem. Oh, look, everybody's busy. I'll have a little myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he gets bolder and bolder and has more and more. And that's when he falls asleep.
That's when he falls asleep, right. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that they've got this this countenance, you know, this grave faces. That's an interesting thing to me is important. Yeah. They're, you know, having a good time, but they're really grave, you know, it's like,
They're otherworldly.
I don't know. To me that kind of portends something, because we'll talk about when it gets up here, but,
oh, okay.
Yeah. So he does fall asleep. Let's see. So then he wakes up, right? On waking, he found himself on the green knoll whence he had first seen the old man of the glen. He rubbed his eyes. It was a bright sunny morning. The birds were hopping and twittering among the bushes, and the eagle was wheeling aloft and breasting the pure mountain breeze. Surely, thought Rip, I have not slept here all night. Yes, you did. A little more than that. And he's like, shall I tell Dame Van Winkle? And he looked around for his gun, and he found it, but it was all, you know, rotten.
Right.
Yeah. And the dog is gone.
Yeah, dog's long gone.
Yeah. So he determined to revisit the scene of last evening's gamble, and if he had met with any of the party to demand his dog and his gun.
Yeah. He gets up and he's like stiff in his joints. He can't move the way he's used to. He's like, wow, that's tough on me sleeping outside like that.
These mountain beds do not agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and then as he's moving along, there's differences in even the geography. The place that he was able, the gully he could walk across was now a stream.
Mm. Yeah.
So he's having to get around the stream.
Right.
And there aren't any traces of where it used to open to the cliffs.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know. You assume that it's just because once we know the end of the story, of course, because it's so famous, is that he slept for more than a night. But it's mysterious. Was it magic that he got through with? And that's what's really good about the story, is it makes it so that you want to read it more than once anyway. So you see the clues once you understand what's going on.
Yeah. Agreed. So then he goes down to the village, right?
Mm-hmm.
And things look very different.
Yes, I like when he's looking, they're kind of, every time somebody sees him, they stroke their chins, and he finally does it himself, and he's like, holy crow, my beard is a foot long. What happened here?
Had a big long beard, yeah.
Yeah.
So I highlighted this. He had now entered the skirts of the village. A troop of strange children ran at his heels, hooting after him and pointing at his gray beard. The dogs, too, not one of which he recognized for an old acquaintance, barked at him as he passed. The very village was altered. It was larger and more populous. There were rows of houses which he had never seen before, and those which had been his familiar haunts had disappeared. Strange names were over the doors, strange faces at the windows. Everything was strange.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that I think is a theme of the story, is just this rapid change. And that's what made me surprised that he was born later, you know, Washington Irving, was mm-hmm. born later than I thought he was, because I thought he was talking about living through the revolution and how mm-hmm. quickly yeah. things had happened. And it's like you fall asleep for a minute and then you wake up. I mean, I've felt that before where things are just happening so quickly that you go to sleep and you wake up and you're like, oh my gosh, it's just like somebody stopped the train for just a minute.
Right.
And now that's what, you know, the story means to me. I mean, it still means that, but it's interesting that I feel like it's sort of a lament against great change, you know, and sort of a desire for simpler times. You know, there's just that kind of melancholy for me, you know, when I read it. It's mm-hmm, and that could be just me bringing my own baggage to the party, right? But well, that's what I feel about the story.
But that's what a good story does, is it opens up all those avenues. And I hadn't thought of that, because the changes, you're right, are so extreme. He gets to the tavern or whatever it is, and they say, hey, who'd you vote for? And he's like, what? Mm. I am a good citizen of King George. And they're like, boo. Because the revolution happened while he was asleep.
Yeah.
And and in that way, everything changed so quickly. I mean, and so radically.
Right. Yeah. And knowing what we know now, I mean, reading it, you know, 200 years something later.
Yeah.
And like you said earlier, you know, for Rip Van Winkle to go up in the mountains and be completely alone, and how, you know, development is touched pretty much everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I live in Utah, and then there's still places you can go out here, you know, where there's nobody. And I imagine in Texas too, isn't?
Yeah.
Texas
yeah.
have large areas mm-hmm. of undeveloped stuff.
Davis Mountain.
Over in the east, you know, I've been on the East Coast, and it's like, you know, you hit the, in the air, you know, you hit the Mississippi River, and then you get not too far past the Mississippi River, and then it's like one big town almost. You know, it almost feels like it just never stops, and all the way to the coast.
From Florida all the way up.
Right, right. It's just a constant, you know, giant city.
Yeah.
Yeah, soon we'll get to Trantor, right? From Asimov's Terminus or whatever,
And it's funny you talking about change, because I actually kind of experienced even a little bit of that, the looking back and kind of laughing at how much simpler we thought, or how much we thought we were advanced. I've been listening to this podcast called Presidential from the Washington Post, and they did it every week before the last presidential election. So 44 weeks out, or however much, they started covering a different president at a time. They're about half an hour long, and they tend to cover things that aren't always the typical biographical podcast stuff. I mean, they don't start off with, he was born here and he married this person. They'll try to take interesting aspects of the presidency or the personality, and then at the end, and they'll talk with you know, experts like David McCullough. I'm listening to the one on Harry Truman, and David McCullough is the guest, as well as somebody on polling, because Truman is the one with the famous, you know, Dewey defeats Truman paper,
right, yeah.
where they had to go early on the paper, and the polls had all said this because they had unconsciously selected the same sort of people. They had limited their polling. They hadn't gone outside the box. And so the guy's like, oh, yeah, well, back then, that's how they did it. And they changed a lot of things, so we don't have that problem now. And I started listening before the election, mm-hmm. but I slowed way down, so I'd just pick one up every so often. And I was listening to this last night just laughing, going, because we're so smart now, that would never happen now. And I'm like, I cannot wait to hear the Trump one, because they came the day after the election, they came out with, you know, the Trump one, which I'm just waiting to listen in order. But I was like, I bet they never thought they were going to have to use that. Nobody did. We all believed that stuff. So thinking of that, I'm just thinking of how different everything is since that very interesting listen on the Truman one was done. Like everything flipped again,
right,
in the same exact ways it did in the past, but it's just as bewildering to us. And that's kind of what you're commenting on in the Rip Van Winkle. It's another look at how things can flip and we still have to adjust to it.
Yeah.
And it happens all the time.
It does. Yeah. We're definitely in sort of a peak change moment at the moment, you know. Just lots of stuff happening.
Well, it happened,
imagine
yeah,
if we slept for a year, it would be pretty crazy.
Right?
I mean, just 1 year, we'd be like, what? Donald Trump is president. Donald Trump?
What did he went for?
Yeah.
Was it 20 years?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I should know this. I did read this story, I swear. A long time.
Right,
yeah,
right.
20 years.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, the men in the mountains are rumored to be the ghosts of Henry Hudson's crew, which vanished long ago.
Hmm.
Yeah, so...
That's right. And it's just interesting to me, you know, what exactly is he saying? You know, he's this... held up as this quintessential American, right? And but he was in Europe. Well, it's just like he's like the first American writer.
I did
listen to a lecture where the guy said he said that Washington Irving wrote like a British person, and it wasn't until after him that there became an American character to it.
Yeah, like Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Exactly. Yeah, and those were becoming quote, American writing, right? But they said, you know, Washington Irving sort of falls, if you look at it, it falls in with the British stuff. But I'm wondering if he's...
I can't tell the difference.
Yeah, if he's... I don't know. I just get stuff out of the story that is more of a lamenting thing than a Hooray America thing, you know?
Well, I don't know if it's... Hooray America, or there's more of a melancholy feature.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I don't think I would have ever thought he was really, I see what you're saying, but I would never have thought of this as a commentary on America. I thought of it, if I'd had been pushed to do it, would have been a commentary on aging and our lives and how things change and we suddenly are aware of it, you know. Maybe that's because I'm more to an age like that.
Yeah.
Where I can look and say, oh yeah, I remember when that happened in the 60s and again in the 80s. And here we are again, thinking it's super new.
Yeah.
And I'm not quite as bad as Rip Van Winkle, but you do long a lot of times for things to be simpler and easier. And were they simpler and easier? No. I was younger. I wasn't looking at all the aspects I might look at now. Or thinking about it the same way. And so this story definitely reflects that. I mean, he didn't love his wife and he gets taken in by his daughter who seems like a nicer person. Hopefully happier than his mother, her mother was. He fits in with everybody eventually again, you know.
Yeah. So it does all work out for him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But that's interesting. I wouldn't have really thought about those changes.
Yeah.
But it does kind of go along with some of the contrasts and comparisons that are in the other story too.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's jump into that.
Okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
No.
Okay.
There's not tons to it.
Yeah. There's not tons to it at all. There's not. Yeah. Let's see. Okay, very near the beginning, just to feed into what we've just been talking about.
Of the Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, so now if I'm in the Legend of Sleepy Hollow, but very near the beginning, there's this paragraph. I mention this peaceful spot with all possible laud, for it is in such little retired Dutch valleys, found here and there embosomed in the great state of New York, that population, manners, and customs remain fixed. While the great torrent of migration and improvement, which is making such incessant changes in other parts of this restless country, sweeps by them unobserved. Right? So he's saying, okay, Sleepy Hollow, you know, the setting of this story,
right,
is in a place that is being bypassed. All the changes that are happening, people are going, they're like jumping over them to get to the places that are changing.
Yeah, and they're perfectly happy with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't care about all that.
But I find
stuff.
That interesting in light of the previous story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, change again is something that's here as well. He's saying this is sort of change free, right?
Here's a
place that is static.
Yeah.
And I think that he likes it.
Well, yeah, and it's one of those small places. You hear about all these towns. I've never really lived in one where they don't worry about the outside world. Hmm. Those are usually these days shown to us in horror films.
You're right, right.
But, yeah, bucolic little spot where everybody knows where they belong.
Hmm.
And into that comes somebody who's from Connecticut. What?
No.
I don't think so.
That's pretty right. Different. That's right. Yeah. So yeah, in this,
I did love that the Connecticut was Connecticut.
New York City.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In this by place of nature, their abode in a remote period of American history, that is to say, some 30 years since, a worthy wight of the name of Ichabod Crane, who sojourned, or as he expressed it, tarried, in Sleepy Hollow for the purpose of instructing the children of the vicinity. He was a native of Connecticut, a state which supplies the Union with pioneers for the mind as well as for the forest, and sends forth yearly its legions of frontier woodmen and country schoolmasters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good stuff. And I love the description, too. He was tall, but exceedingly lank, with narrow shoulders, long arms and legs, hands that dangled a mile out of his sleeves, feet that might have served for shovels, and his whole frame most loosely hung together. His head was small and flat at the top, with huge ears, large green glassy eyes, and a long snip nose, so that it looked like a weathercock perched upon his spindle neck to tell which way the wind blew. To see him striding along the profile of a hill on a windy day, with his clothes bagging and fluttering about him, one might have mistaken him for the genius of famine descending upon the earth, or some scarecrow eloped from a cornfield.
Yes.
Wow. That guy is not Carl Urban at all.
He is not. And then when you find out his more about him personally,
mm-hmm.
his exterior of this unattractive exterior seems reflected on the interior. And mm-hmm. it's not that he's horrible. It's just there's not much admirable, I think, we're told. He's, you know, always hungry,
mm-hmm.
which I understand. You know, he's a tall, skinny guy, so he's always hungry. He likes to beat the kids, which is, you know, this is Schoolmaster 101 back mm-hmm. in the day. So I get it. But it did seem like he was pretty free with it because he didn't want to mess with them.
Mm.
He is fascinated. It's interesting, though, because he has quite the imagination, I guess, because he's fascinated by ghost stories and witch stories and all that kind of thing. The supernatural.
Mm. Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he gets passed around from household to household once a week or every so often. And that's also, I'd forgotten that. I was like, oh, right. That's what small communities used to do. Everybody would take care of the schoolmaster.
Yeah, right.
You know,
and that's an interesting connection, too, to the previous story. Because remember how it said that Rip Van Winkle was, you know, hanging around all the women?
Mm-hmm.
There's a paragraph here. The schoolmaster is generally a man of some importance in the female circle of a rural neighborhood, being considered a kind of idle, gentleman-like personage of vastly superior tastes and accomplishments to the rough country swains, and indeed inferior in learning only to the parson.
Ooh.
Isn't that? Yeah. And then he says, later it says, he was, moreover, esteemed by the women as a man of great erudition, for he had read several books quite through, and was a perfect master of Cotton Mather's History of New England Witchcraft, in which, by the way, he most firmly and potently believed.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's an interesting detail that jumped out to me as a connection. So Rip Van Winkle and him. It's like they're different from all the people that are out doing the work, you know?
Oh, yeah. They're the intelligentsia,
right.
So to speak.
I guess so, yeah. For Rip Van Winkle, he was lazy and not wanting to work, right? But all the men in the village out working all day,
right?
You know, and then same here, you know, just, you know, Ichabod Crane is not lazy. He's a schoolmaster. He's just around.
Yeah. He's got a different schedule than everybody else.
Right.
And it does say he makes himself agreeable, because he would help the farmers with the light labors, the lighter labors. You know, he'd take care of the kids for the mothers, or, you know, kind of hold them up as, oh, what a beautiful child, kind of thing. And it does make me think that, you know, he's not, he's always shown as a figure of fun.
Yeah.
But it does say that the life of a schoolmaster can be kind of tough, especially if you're getting passed from family to family. You want those families to like you.
Yeah.
So he's doing these things to be likable.
Right.
You know, he wants to fit in where he is. I mean, it doesn't tell us a lot about his personality, but he didn't have to do any of that stuff. And then he also earns extra money by being a singing master and instructing the young folks in psalmody. I don't know what that is. I assume it's singing psalms.
Singing psalms, right.
But
he's very good. I picture him just singing louder than everybody else.
Yeah. It says you could hear him half a mile off with his peculiar quaver.
Oh, I love it.
Goodness.
And among those musical disciples who assembled one evening in each week to receive his instruction in psalmody was Katrina Van Tassel, the daughter and only child of a substantial Dutch farmer. And this description just kills me. It's good stuff. She was a blooming lass of fresh 18, plump as a partridge, ripe and melting and rosy-cheeked as one of her father's peaches, and universally famed not merely for her beauty, but her vast expectations. I love it. That's good stuff.
She is just, it says, she was withal a little of a coquette, as might be perceived even in her dress, which was a mixture of ancient and modern fashions as most suited to set off her charms. So, yeah, she's, you know, the head cheerleader of the school. I'm just saying. Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
Everybody wants Katrina, and Katrina knows it.
That's right.
You know, and it doesn't mean that she's mean necessarily. She's just, you know, I know what I look like. Might as well set it off.
That's right.
It's funny because you were talking about the perfect, not perfect American, but at one point we were exchanging emails yesterday, and you were saying, you know, classic American portrayed in this, these stories. And to me, it's her father. This is the admirable American.
Interesting.
He's a farmer. He's prosperous, but he's open-handed with it.
Right,
let's have a party and look at all the food. And I just want everybody to have a good time, you know?
Yeah. Good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was looking at Ichabod as possibly sort of a throwback to old times. And the guy that we're about to talk about, Brahm, as the quintessential American.
It's funny because I look at Ichabod as he's from, you know, Connecticut. He's learned. He's making himself agreeable and wants to fit in. I looked at him as a modernizing force.
Interesting.
Not actively, not, but, you know, he's the outsider who's going to change people's minds or how they think, or, you know, he's just that little irritant in the pearl or in the oyster that it has to cover over.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, Ichabod is smitten, right, with Katrina. But Katrina
I'm always smitten with her, frankly, from that description. I would date her.
But Katrina has other suitors, right?
Everyone.
Among these, the most formidable was a burly, roaring, roistering blade of the name of Abraham, or according to the Dutch abbreviation, Brahm, Van Brunt, the hero of the country round, which rang with his feats of strength and hardihood. He was broad-shouldered and double-jointed, with short, curly black hair, and a bluff but not unpleasant countenance, having a mingled air of fun and arrogance. From his Herculean frame and great powers of limb, he had received the nickname of Brahm Bones, by which he was universally known. He was famed for great knowledge and skill in horsemanship, being as dexterous on horseback as a Tartar. He was foremost at all races and cockfights, and, with the ascendancy which bodily strength acquires in rustic life, was the umpire in all disputes. setting his hat on one side and giving his decisions with an air and tone admitting of no gainsay or appeal. He was always ready for either a fight or a frolic, but had more mischief than ill will in his composition. And with all his overbearing roughness, there was a strong dash of waggish good humor at the bottom. That's Brahm.
So here we have the captain of the football team.
That's right. The quarterback.
Not a bad guy.
The next sentence even says he has three or four boon companions.
Right. Yeah.
So yeah, yeah. That's hilarious.
I could just see him with his letter jacket and his convertible and his buddies.
How funny.
You know, not a bad guy. He's waggish, more fun than mean, it says.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely the exact opposite to Ichabod Crane. And Ichabod Crane has not been presented as, you know, an admirable scholar. He's just very different from Brahm.
Yeah, yeah. That's true, yeah.
Oh, gracious.
Yeah. So now,
the underdog and the main guy and the girl they both want. And the problem is the underdog is not somebody we can even admire. We're kind of like, you're not going to win. And that's, I get it. I wouldn't let you marry my daughter either, frankly, but okay.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. So then now they're going to go to a party, right? You know? And I love this. The gallant Ichabod now spent at least an extra half hour at his toilet, brushing and furbishing up his best and indeed only suit of rusty black, and arranging his locks by a bit of broken-looking glass that hung up in the schoolhouse. Yeah, so he's getting ready. Right? And then they give him a steed. Oh, I just laugh out loud. The animal he bestrode was a broken-down plow horse that had outlived almost everything but his viciousness.
Yes.
He was gaunt and shagged with a ewe neck and a head like a hammer. His rusty mane and tail were tangled and knotted with burrs. One eye had lost its pupil and was glaring and spectral, but the other had the gleam of a genuine devil in it. Still, it must have had fire and metal in his day, if we may judge from the name he bore of Gunpowder.
Ooh.
Oh, man, that's awesome. Oh, I just love it.
I know. I love that so much.
Yeah.
So,
oh, shoot.
And what's kind of interesting, too, is Ichabod Crane is going to the party, or he's thinking about Katrina at some point. This might be before he's getting ready for the party. No, he's on his way. But what it shows is that he thinks he's got a chance with her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So he's a bit dim, but anyway, he is looking at everything as he gets close to the house, and it's all transformed into food that he might eat. You know, this, like, he's talked about, he's seen the chickens and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, geese were swimming in their own gravy and the ducks pairing cozily in dishes like snug married couples with a decent competency of onion sauce.
The
porkers, he saw carved out the future sleek side of bacon and juicy relishing ham. And it goes on and on and on. And so then he's looking at all the land and going, oh, and you know what I could do with this? I could sell all of it and get all this money and then take Katrina and my big family of children and my wagon with everything. And we're going to go to Kentucky or Tennessee and we're going to adventure, which I'm like, where did that come from? You know, who knew that this was what he had deep in his heart? Because the funny thing is if he does that, he doesn't get all that other stuff he wants.
Yeah.
You don't have the farm that's providing your lovely dinners and everything if you're going off and adventuring. So that doesn't mean that anything. It's just kind of interesting to me. And then it says, so when he enters, the conquest of his heart was complete because this is like the best house ever. And it's described wonderfully. I wanted to live there also.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of decided this is pretty much a done deal. He gets there and he's like,
so
okay,
good.
How do I get her to like me? Because we're set. I don't think it's going to take that much, frankly. Don't you think?
I do think, yeah. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and he's just, and it's just like, okay, so you're also an idiot. But the main thing to me is I looked at this and for the first time thinking about it more since we talk about it, I realized, of course, that he never, ever thinks about Katrina other than a possession.
You're right. You're right. Yep.
I didn't notice the same thing. He's never thinking about what she'd like or, oh, mm-hmm. I like this about her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just she's one of the things like the chickens and the ducks and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
she'll have my big family of children and we'll move on to Kentucky.
Oh, heck yeah.
So, and part of that is that his head is in the clouds and he doesn't have a good sense of reality at all.
Mm.
But the other part is just that he's purely thinking of acquisition.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yep, I agree.
And I could get it. I mean, the life of a school teacher, he's moved from house to house. He doesn't have anywhere settled to live. But, you know, it's not making us feel like he's the best guy on earth.
Yeah, right.
So,
absolutely. Yeah, there's one other really funny line about Ichabod mm-hmm. and his singing and his, but you know, he's a better dancer than he is a singer even. This is Ichabod prided himself upon his dancing as much as upon his vocal powers. Not a limb, not a fiber about him was idle. And to have seen his loosely hung frame in full motion and clattering about the room, you would have thought St. Vitus himself, that blessed patron of the dance, was figuring before you in person. Oh, good stuff. Good stuff.
He's just a charmer. We want him.
Oh, heck yeah.
Unlike Brom Bones, who's described during the middle of all this, you know, and this is the thing where he's, you know, broad chested and shouldered and double jointed. I don't know why that came up, but there you go.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
Good question.
And, wow. You know, then he says, as the author steps out, the narrator says, I profess not to know how women's hearts are wooed and won. To me, they have always been matters of riddle and admiration. Some seem to have but one vulnerable point or door of access, while others have a thousand avenues and may be captured in a thousand different ways. And so he's talking about the fact that no one can really know who she wants.
So you're saying there's a chance.
Well, that's what he's thinking. Brombones seems to think otherwise.
That's right, that's right.
But, yeah, you kind of get the idea, basically, that she's using Ichabod to get to Brom Bones.
Yeah, yeah. For sure, for sure.
Or just to make him a little jealous, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I like his steed is named, Brom Bones' steed is named Daredevil.
Daredevil and Gunpowder. I like it. Yeah.
A creature like himself, full of metal and mischief, and which no one but himself could manage. He was, in fact, noted for preferring vicious animals, given to all kinds of tricks, which kept the rider in constant risk of his neck, for he held a tractable, well-broken horse as unworthy of, as unworthy of a lad of spirit. I'm liking him more and more.
Yeah, it's like, dun-da. I can do this.
Yes. I need to break you.
I like it. I like it. Yeah. So, yeah, into this environment comes Ghostly Tales now.
Right.
Yeah, so I highlighted this. But all these were nothing to the tales of ghosts and apparitions that succeeded. So it's talking about some that didn't. The neighborhood is rich in legendary treasures of the kind. Local tales and superstitions thrive best in these sheltered, long-settled retreats, but are trampled underfoot by the shifting throng that forms the population of most of our country places. Besides, there is no encouragement for ghosts in most of our villages, for they have scarcely had time to finish their first nap and turn themselves in their graves before their surviving friends have traveled away from the neighborhood, so that when they turn out at night to walk their rounds, they have no acquaintance left to call upon. This is perhaps the reason why we so seldom hear of ghosts, except in our long-established Dutch communities. So again, another reference to rapid change.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The chief part of the stories, however, this is a little bit later, turned upon the favorite specter of Sleepy Hollow, the Headless Horseman, who had been heard several times of late patrolling the country, and it was said tethered his horse nightly among the graves in the churchyard. Oh, yeah. Now we're talking.
And Brom Bone says, he's not such a big deal. I ran into him at the crossroads once.
Yeah.
Or somewhere nearby. Yeah. That's raced him. It was fine.
I kicked his butt more than once.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
I raced him for a bowl of punch. I'd have won. But he cheated. Because when we got to the church bridge, the Hessian bolted and vanished in a flash of fire.
That's right.
So he's tough. We know it.
That's right. Heck yeah. And then there was a tale of old Brower, the most heretical disbeliever in ghosts, how he met the horseman returning from his foray into Sleepy Hollow and was obliged to get up behind him. Galloped over bush and brake, over hill and swamp, until they reached the bridge, when the horseman suddenly turned into a skeleton, threw old Brower into the brook, and sprang away over the treetops with a clap of thunder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
and then right after that it says, this story was immediately matched by a thrice marvelous adventure of Brom Bones.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
Yeah. He's not that big a deal.
Right. And then Ichabod repaid them in kind with large extracts from his invaluable author, Cotton Mather, and added many marvelous events that had taken place in his native state of Connecticut and fearful sights which he had seen in his nightly walks about Sleepy Hollow. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now I just want to say, then they break up for the night.
Right.
That is the best frame of mind to go out into a completely pitch black night where there are no lights or anything. By yourself down an old country road. And plus, Ichabod stays behind to kind of like get a little closer to Katrina while nobody's around.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. But it's not to be.
No. These women. Could that girl have been playing off any of her coquettish tricks? Was her encouragement of the poor pedagogue all a mere sham to secure her conquest of his rival? Heaven only knows, not I. Oh, we all know.
We do know. Come on.
Yeah, come on. Yep. And this is when Ichabod's like, damn it, I spent half an hour on my hair.
Oh, shoot.
I had counted on my wonderful future.
It was the very witching hour, or the very witching time of night, that Ichabod, heavy-hearted and crestfallen, pursued his travel homewards along the sides of the lofty hills which rise above Tarrytown and which he had traversed so cheerily in the afternoon. The hour was as dismal as himself, this poor guy.
I know. I feel sorry for him.
That's right. In the dead hush of midnight, he couldn't even hear the barking of the watchdog from the opposite shore of the Hudson. But it was, that's a cool detail. But it was so vague and faint as only to give an idea of his distance from this faithful companion of man. It's like, warning.
Well, I was just thinking, because it says, now and then, too, the long-drawn crowing of a cock accidentally awakened would sound far, far off from some farmhouse away among the hills. But it was like a dreaming sound in his ears. No signs of life occurred near him, but occasionally the melancholy chirp of a cricket, or perhaps the guttural twang of a bullfrog from a neighboring marsh, as if sleeping uncomfortably and turning suddenly in his bed.
Hmm.
You know, if you're out in the country and you're out at a certain time of night, those are just the sounds you hear.
Yeah.
Just enough to remind you that there are other creatures around, but you're essentially isolated. It's a lovely image to take away, I think.
Well done. Yeah. And then here's to speak to the point you made earlier about his mindset. You know, all the stories of ghosts and goblins that he heard in the afternoon now came crowding upon his recollection. Oh, yeah. I was telling these stories earlier.
I have to, my thing is, I have finally learned after a lifetime that I have to not read things with scary stuff in them before I go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I keep American history by the bed for that. That puts me to sleep and it's long ago. It doesn't give me horrible dreams.
That's good.
Well, I like this. And it says he'd never felt so lonely and dismal. He was, moreover, approaching the very place where many of the scenes of the ghost stories had been laid. And you're just like, oh, this is the worst possible thing.
Yeah. In the center of a road stood an enormous tulip tree, which towered like a giant above all other trees of the neighborhood and formed a kind of landmark. Its limbs were gnarled and fantastic, large enough to form trunks for ordinary trees, twisting down almost to the earth and rising again into the air. It was connected with the tragical story of the unfortunate Andre, who had been taken prisoner hard by and was universally known by the name of Major Andre's Tree. The common people regarded it with a mixture of respect and superstition, partly out of sympathy for the fate of its ill-starred namesake, and partly from the tales of strange sights and doleful lamentations told concerning it.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a funny thing, too, is how much of that history is embedded if you've read enough stuff, or just even from, I find it hard to imagine I would remember this from school, but maybe, you know, I saw Major Andre and I was like, oh, he was a spy, right? And I had to look him up, but yeah, he was a British spy
right.
who they caught and hanged for helping Benedict Arnold.
Mm.
He's the one who didn't make it out alive.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
As Ichabod approached his fearful tree, he began to whistle. He thought his whistle was answered, but it was a blast sweeping sharply through the dry branches. Phew!
Oh, okay. That's fine. As he approached a little nearer, he thought he saw something white hanging in the midst of the tree. He paused and ceased whistling, but on looking more narrowly, perceived that it was a place where the tree had been scathed by lightning and the white wood laid bare. Oh, thank goodness. Yeah.
That's all right. Yeah. Suddenly he heard a groan. His teeth chattered and his knees smote against the saddle. It was but the rubbing of one huge bough upon another as they were swayed about by the breeze. He passed He passed the tree in safety, but new perils lay before him.
All the ways that you just freak yourself out.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, then however.
The bridge, yeah.
He's not going to be so lucky in the future.
No, he's not. Yeah, so he's skipping ahead just a touch here. Let's see.
So there's a haunted stream that the bridge goes over.
Right, right.
Pretty freaked out about it. But he can do it. Gunpowder can probably do it. I'll just kick him hard.
That's right.
Gunpowder. Anybody who's ever ridden a horse is like, gosh. I don't think so. It just starts going sideways. You know, I'm just like, so, what do you stop it? And the horse's like, nope. There's gunpowder for you.
Yeah. Yeah. As he approached the stream, his heart began to thump. He summoned up all his resolution, gave his horse half a score of kicks in the ribs, and attempted to dash briskly across the bridge. But instead of starting forward, the perverse old animal made a lateral movement. and ran broadside against the fence. Ichabod, whose fears increased with the delay, jerked the reins on the other side and kicked lustily with the contrary foot. It was all in vain. His steed started, it is true, but it was only to plunge to the opposite side of the road into a thicket of brambles and alder bushes. The schoolmaster now bestowed both whip and heel upon the starveling ribs of old Gunpowder, who dashed forward snuffing and snorting, but came to a stand just by the bridge with a suddenness that had nearly sent his rider sprawling over his head. Just at this moment, a plashy tramp by the side of the bridge caught the sensitive ear of Ichabod. In the dark shadow of the grove on the margin of the brook, he beheld something huge, misshapen, black, and towering. It stirred not, but seemed gathered up in the gloom, like some gigantic monster ready to spring upon the traveler. Holy smokes. It was hilarious, and all of a sudden, like, oh no.
Wait a minute, this has just got real. When he's like, who are you? Nope, nothing.
Yeah.
But he's like, so he shut his eyes and broke forth with involuntary fervor into a psalm tune.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to sing to the Lord.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the Lord does not answer, because then comes this huge horse, apparition, gigantic horseman.
Yeah.
He's just going to ride next to you on the horse's blind side, so it doesn't freak him out too much.
Right.
No problem. No worries.
Oh, my gosh.
Wait. Hold on. I can see you against the sky now. Wait, oh, where's your head? Hold on.
Oh, man.
I knew you weren't a friend, but damn.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, now we're freaking out. Right. Now he is hitting gunpowder so much that even gunpowder's got to go. Yeah, they're both going, keeping pace. And right. I love this where it says, away then they dashed through thick and thin, stones flying and sparks flashing at every bound. Ichabod's flimsy garments fluttered in the air as he stretched his long, lank body way over his horse's head in the eagerness of his flight.
Hmm.
It's just desperate. And it says they had now reached the road, which turns off to Sleepy Hollow. But Gunpowder, who seemed possessed with a demon, instead of keeping up it, made an opposite turn and plunged headlong down the hill to the left. Anyway, so I just Gunpowder's now living up to his name.
Yep. Wow.
Yep.
It's amazing. Yeah, so good. And then Ichabod's just hanging on the pommel. He's all he can do just to stay on.
And the saddle comes off.
Yeah.
So he's having to hang on. The saddle's sliding around and it comes off. And it says, for a moment, the terror of Hans von Ripper's wrath passed across his mind, for it was his Sunday saddle. But this was no time for petty fears.
Yeah.
The goblin was hard on his haunches. But I could just see him in the middle of it. No, not the Sunday saddle.
Yep.
Oh, gracious.
Yep. And then he thinks to himself, if I can reach that bridge, thought Ichabod, I am safe. Not sure why he thinks that, but he does.
Because when Brom Bones, telling his story, he says he burst into flame at the bridge.
That's right.
And flames didn't go at the all bridge, the way.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Another convulsive kick in the ribs. He's still hanging on to old Gunpowder.
Yeah.
He thundered over the resounding planks. He gained the opposite side, and now Ichabod cast a look behind to see if his pursuer should vanish according to rule. In a flash of fire and brimstone. Just then he saw the goblin rising in his stirrups and in the very act of hurling his head at him. Ichabod endeavored to dodge the horrible missile, but too late. It encountered his cranium with a tremendous crash, and he was tumbled headlong into the dust, and Gunpowder, the black steed, and the goblin rider passed by like a whirlwind.
Yeah.
The end.
Dun,
right?
Dun.
And now the next paragraph is the next morning. The next morning, the old horse was found. It just like, no break whatsoever. Without the saddle. Yep. Without a saddle and the bridle under his feet, soberly cropping the grass at his master's gate. Ichabod did not make his appearance at breakfast. Dinner hour came, but no Ichabod. The boys assembled at the schoolhouse and strolled idly about the banks of the brook, but no schoolmaster. Hans van Ripper now began to feel some uneasiness about the fate of poor Ichabod and his saddle.
And his saddle.
And it goes from there. Yeah. And his saddle, right?
Also.
What the hell? I lent him my saddle. That was my Sunday saddle.
Yeah. The horse is almost dead, but that was my good saddle.
Oh,
Ichabod.
Man. Yeah.
Come back with the saddle.
That Ichabod.
Yeah. So they get worried. They start searching. They find traces of, horse's hooves and his hat. And a splattered pumpkin.
Yeah, so there's the pumpkin, right?
So then we're let in on the secret.
Yeah.
We are now told, basically, that, if you were wondering, and the first time these stories must have been read, there's so much in American culture, especially at Halloween. You feel like everybody's exposed to this pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's terrifying until you find out it's a pumpkin and not his head.
Right, right.
And, all his stuff's left behind. He just vamoosed out of there. So what I love is, then, of course, they all start telling stories. Mm-hmm. We all remember how this works out. And he kind of goes down in local history.
Yeah.
They sell off his stuff or keep it themselves, and they get a new schoolmaster. And he didn't owe anyone money, so whatever. He was a bachelor. Too bad. And then an old farmer who'd gone down to New York on a visit, and he says, from whom this account was received. So that means, Washington Irving, or whoever it was, Jeffrey Crayon, ran into him. He told me the story. And he said he brought home the intelligence that Ichabod Crane was still alive. that he had left the neighborhood partly through fear of the goblin and Hans van Ripper, and partly in mortification at having been suddenly dismissed by the heiress, that he had changed his quarters to a different part of the country, had kept school and studied law at the same time, been admitted to the bar, turned politician, electioneered, written for the newspapers, and finally been made a justice of the 10-pound court.
Hmm.
So in a way, it was the making of him.
Yeah, yeah. How interesting that is, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That horrible cool. experience forced him to go do something else.
That's right. Wow.
And Brom Bones?
That's good.
He just always laughed at that story and married Katrina.
That's right. Ka-ching. Ka-ching. Oh, I like it.
Yep.
Man, I love that story.
And the old country wives, though, who are the best judges of these tales, of these matters, say, no, 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 no. So they keep it as a ghost story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's much better as a ghost story.
They maintain to this day that Ichabod was spirited away by supernatural means. And it's one of their favorite stories. Yeah. Yep. I love it. I love it. Ah, that was fun. Mm-hmm. It was fun to go through it like that because it's so funny. I mean, when you read it like this, it's a comedy. Until the very end, it's just horrifying. So.
Well, I know, and the funny thing is you think of Ichabod as the funny thing in the story, and of course it is, but there are a lot of those funny little points, like the thing about the horse, the description of gunpowder.
Yeah.
That sort of thing.
Right.
And there are all these, and, you know, and he was kind of worried about Ichabod and his saddle.
Yeah. That is funny, you know, these details like that.
Yeah. It's like it things out of proportion here.
No, I love it.
There's also the matter of my saddle. That was expensive.
Yeah.
I also like that you have a Sunday saddle. Like you put on your Sunday suit, you put the Heck Sunday saddle on your horse. It makes absolute sense, you know. But I just wouldn't have thought of it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I do recall talking about this story in elementary school.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Who knows how much of it we read or anything, but...
Mm-hmm.
It is a elementary school memory.
Yeah, because it can be understood. Yeah. Well, you know, it doesn't set out to mean more than it means. You and I can look at these stories and say, oh, well, here are the elements of change. Here are the elements of this sort of a person from outside the community coming in. And those things are there, but he's not really necessarily making points with those. Those are elements that we're all familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
That are springboards for the story too.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's there if you want to kind of go, oh, yeah, that's kind of how I feel right now. But if you don't, anybody can love these stories, and that's surely why he was looked at as a great author.
Yeah, yeah.
They're very accessible. And to anybody who's listening, and I know we have one devoted listener in Germany. Hi, Mark. We
Mark.
Love you. These stories are so American. Every American is exposed to them in popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
They are read, as you said, in elementary school. People refer to them a lot. If you say elements of them, like, you know, Major Andre, I was like, ah, Major Andre, he was that British spy that was hung, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are little things in here that are just such a part of our culture and history. They're very American. If you want to know a little bit about America and the things we think are good, these are some stories to read. Like, everybody kind of like to belong to Sleepy Hollow. New England is America's home. Everybody lives somewhere else. But I think I read somewhere where they said most Americans also would love to live in New England for a while or at least visit it.
Hmm.
We all think of it kind of as a second home that way.
That's interesting.
In our country.
Yeah, I think you're right on that.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I've never heard it just stated like that before.
Yeah, and I can't remember where I read it, but it resonated with me. I went, oh, yeah, we all know what it looks like. That's where we would like to go to see the fall leaves. It would be like an American place of pilgrimage.
Yeah.
The Revolution happened there.
Mm-hmm.
You go to Boston, and you go to Little Italy, or you'll do this, but you're walking around and looking at where Paul Revere lived and, you know, the Revolutionary Trail and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But for even sure. before that, yeah. It's just part of our bones.
Yeah, cool.
Yep.
Good point. And, the Headless Horseman is a constant symbol of Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Here. You know, I don't know what Halloween is like everywhere else in the world. But here.
In different places, it's not, in most places, I don't think it's really celebrated, or it's celebrated differently, because, you know, that gets into the whole history of Halloween.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it started as All Hallows Eve, or All Hallows Eve, because the importance of it was the day before All Saints Day.
Yeah.
Where the Catholic Church celebrates saints, all saints, the saints we know and the saints we don't know, meaning the saints the church doesn't recognize because they just weren't important enough. There's all kinds of saints. Everybody who gets to heaven is a saint.
Mm.
And then after that, the second day of November is All Souls Day, and that's where you pray for and commemorate everybody you know who's dead.
Right, right.
And pray for them. And so, you know, the way the church looks at Halloween, it's funny because now, and I think we've talked about this before, but here's a good place to mention it, is, you know, Christians, I never thought Halloween was a big deal in terms of worrying about it. And then I became Christian and ran into all these people who were like worried about it, like the boogeyman's going to come get them. You can't celebrate it. Oh, I'll let my kids dress up, but only as saints. And I'm just like, oh, that's super fun. Way to really celebrate the holiday. And to me, it was kind of silly because I was like, well, you know, has Jesus conquered death or not? Are we supposed to worry? I mean, you know, I get that we need to be conscious of the devil. You know, Peter said, you know, don't forget the devil's always around you like a lion. So keep an eye out. But if you allow that to dominate your thinking and your life, you're forgetting the joy and meaning of our lives was set forth for us by Jesus. His resurrection means that we don't have to worry about that if we're doing the best we can and staying faithful.
Yeah.
Does that sound right?
Oh, yeah. No, it does sound right. Absolutely. Yep. And I agree with you. Yep.
Okay.
You have the same kind of stuff, you know, with things like Harry Potter. People are afraid to read Harry Potter and stuff. It kind of stems from the same kind of thing, I think. But you know, I certainly don't feel that way. Yeah.
Yeah, a simplistic fear, I think,
mm-hmm.
of Harry Potter magic. What? Well, take a look at the whole thing in context.
Yeah.
That's a literary device in that case. What are they doing with it?
Mm.
What else is happening?
Yeah, yeah.
And Halloween is the same way. I mean, the whole idea is of Halloween, if what you're doing is mocking the devil and laughing because I'm dressed up, I'm scary. Yeah, that's making fun of it. And, you know, well, that's one of the things he doesn't like. If you're worried about the devil, just laugh at him.
Not a fan of being laughed at, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So true, yeah.
Yeah. Reject
Lots
him
of great Halloween memories.
Mm-hmm.
I've got lots of, it was always really great fun.
Yeah. And I know we've talked about this before, so.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, previous October episodes, I'm sure this has come up, but I just thought.
No, I love that. And you had a great post on your blog, too, about this. That we should link to. Yeah.
Yeah, we will. That's from the Flicks That Church Forgot, which is a British clergyman or pastor who has a podcast talking about horror movies. And it started off and he was talking about, you know, a movie that he liked and then the Christian themes that were underneath or how it made him think of other Christian things. He's kind of veered away from that more as time has gone on and is more just talking about the movies themselves specifically. But I do have links in that post to three different episodes he did about Halloween and Christianity.
Nice.
And those are very good. And the links are still active and he's on iTunes. So
wonderful.
Definitely. If you're interested in that, I think he talks about it really, really well.
Good, good, good.
Yeah.
Well, great. All right. Well, I think we'll call that a show. This actually went much longer than I thought.
Oh,
but that's
no.
Okay. Yeah.
You'll have to severely edit some parts.
That's right. That's right. Well, what's coming up for us in November? We're gonna watch Rocky.
Yay!
The first Rocky film. Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Something else that's very American.
You bet. You bet.
Although newer. Yes.
So sounds good. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I am too. I'm so glad you picked it. I love that movie.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Don't eat too much candy.
All right. We'll see you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.